Accession number 29954, Reel 4.
Eric Sanders, Reel 4.
And I have to go faster through my life.
No.
I worked there regularly. I founded a staff club, which had hundreds of members, and we ran dances for them, and I had a wonderful social life. And in between, we worked. And
did you find your English as well rapidly?
My
improved?
English was getting better and better and better. But not yet as good as it did when I started studying during the war, whilst I was in the army. Because it got better, but not I did not consciously improve it. It got better simply. And it must have sounded quite funny, because I obviously had an Austrian accent. I think you can still hear bits and pieces now. But I was much stronger. And it is stronger now than it used to be, because as you get older, I've been told. Yeah, and I have noticed it. I hear it myself. Then for tuppence, you could go to the cinema. On Saturday afternoons, I always went to the cinema, and sometimes listened to the same film, saw the same film twice, because you could stay in the cinema once you were in it for as long as you like. And so I absorbed an awful lot of American English. And then I, of course, living in the East End and mixing with my uncle and my aunt and all their friends and relations, I had quite a social life with them. It was a Jewish East End English. So this mixture of Austrian, Jewish East End and Americanism must have been quite something. I would have liked to, pity couldn't take a tape in retrospect. And my English got better, but it was also useful for me, because I was one of the best English speakers amongst those kids, and I got better and better job. I started off as lift boy, and the lift that they had at Woburn House was one of those that you had to pull up with a rope or bring down, and I became very skilled in making it stop exactly so that nobody could stumble and so on. And I liked being popular, so I always try and help everybody. It was nice to be called, what a nice boy you are. And then the organization became so large, so many refugees came over, that they moved from Woburn House to Bloomsbury House, which is further down near the British Museum. I had a very good time. And in between, I think I did a lot of things helping people. I helped one friend of mine, the daughter and wife of the man who was looking after my stamp album, which I've never seen again, came to this country, and she still keeps telling me that I saved her life, but it's not true. I mean, that's just an exaggerated way of looking at it. But they were a family that had no contact anywhere. Sorry, I'm beginning to swallow words at the end of a sentence. That is not very good when you're being interviewed with a tape. Meanwhile, my father had the greatest difficulties. He managed to get a visitor's permit to Belgium. I think bribing somebody with whom he'd known whilst he was working, some very inferior employee at the Belgian embassy, but somehow, I'm not sure about this, but he got a visitor's permit, 3 months, and he came to Brussels around January 39, I believe. I happen to know this date because I've only just been writing on this phase of my life. And we had applied for a visa for him on two different grounds. One of them was to work as an agricultural worker, because he'd had some experience in the First World War on working on a farm. But that type of permit and visa took a long, long time. And in any case, the Home Office was so crowded with applications, you can imagine that they fell behind with everything. And the people at Bloomsbury House although I was working there and was quite well known by many of them because I spoke English so well, I even became practically a private secretary at the end to one of them. There's no way in which you can hurry the Home Office. There is no way. There are considerably worse cases than your father. People in much greater danger. My father was caught and put in prison and was going to be sent back to Austria. And that's what the Belgian government had done. That was their only way of coping with all these people who tried to hide and stay there. And we got frantic. I got crazy with fear and worry. And we sent telegrams to the prisoner governor telling him that we were expecting a permit. And one of the officials at Bloomsbury House sent one. And we were very lucky because just around that time, the British and American governments had persuaded the Belgian government to stop sending people back. They guaranteed they would sooner or later absorb them, take them in. So my father was not sent back to Austria, but put into a camp called Merksplatz. Probably a Flemish word, which must have been terrible. It had absolutely nothing. It had no toilet facilities, no washing facilities, not hardly any roofs. It was mud and everything. And my father's letters became very unhappy. I mentioned before I had other problems with the English language. My first job at Woburn House. My second job, after being a lift boy, I was a runner, bringing cards and so on. There was a man called Mr. Nathan, whose office was on the stage. There wasn't enough room there, so a lot of offices were in a hall and stage. And he gave me a small tin, a shoe cream tin, and said to me, "Will you throw this away?" So I took it and went outside, and I didn't know where to throw it away. So I came back with it and I said, "Well, I don't know where to throw it." He said, "Well, there are those big bins outside, just throw it into one of them." So I went into one of those big bins and threw it into there. What I hadn't realized is that what he had given me was what he used as an ashtray. And I was supposed to throw the ashes away, not the whole tin. And several days afterwards he said, "Have you seen this, my ashtray?" I said, "But what do you mean?" I said, "Well, the tin, you know, you remember?" I said, "No." That's another typical experience of my wonderful English. "Well, a man gave me a tin, said, throw it away, throw this away." He didn't say throw it away. I didn't even notice there were ashes in it, hardly any. And eventually, war was declared in September, but I think in July my father arrived here. He was registered at Bloomsbury House, received a grant, and he began to look around for a job. By that time, we had our own little flat, which cost 30 shillings a week. That is £1.50 nowadays. Yeah? That's right. 20 shillings was a pound, and ten was half a pound. So for £1.50, we had a little flat. My mother and I, and my father joined us. And at one time we had two of my friends living there as well. So there must have been another room which they shared. And he found a job outside Basingstoke, a place called North Oakley Farm in Hannington, near Kingsclere. And his job was on the fields, and he got me a job as a dairy boy, and my mother and I left London and went there, and we had half of a cottage side by side, sharing it side by side with another farm worker. They were tight cottages, you know the term. Mm-hmm. And in front of it was a longish narrow garden going slightly downhill towards the road, and at the end of it there were stone stairs to the road, down to the road. But there was no toilet, no indoor toilet. There was an outdoor toilet, one of those big hole things, which once in a while had to be emptied. And I remember my father and I having to dig out everything for a lorry that was coming to collect. I can't quite remember the detail. I can't remember where we had running water, but we must have had running water. I think it was outdoors. But there was no electric light. It was an oil lamp, which we still have downstairs, converted into an electric light. The oil lamp, is it up here? I think it's downstairs in the hall. I'm not sure. I'll show it to you when we go down, if I remember, if you want to see it. I'm sure you'd be thrilled to death. But I had to get up earlier than anyone else, because I had to be on the... All the cows on that farm were kept outdoors, even in the winter. This was a method of saving a lot of money, making it cheap. Not nice for the cows. Sometimes they had icicles hanging from them. But they were outdoors all the time and had to be milked twice a day. And first time was 5 in the morning. I had to get up at 4. Shivering downstairs, my mother had always prepared me a bottle, what do you call it, bottle of coffee, a thermos flask. Funnily enough, my wife does that now. When I get up, there's a thermos flask waiting for me. History repeats itself, but why she does it, I don't know. I think she got fed up with my coming downstairs to the kitchen a bit late and starting to have my breakfast in front of her when she had already been working for an hour. Because I'm a late get-upper and a late going to bedder. And I've just invented that word. And so I had this hot coffee, tea, whatever it was. Sorry, I apologize. And then walked out, and sometimes quite a distance, because the cows were moved to different meadows. There were two herds of 50 cows. I never saw the other 50. I had to go out there. The first thing we had to do was to build a kind of a barbed wire fence as a kind of enclosure. The bale had to be pulled by the horse to where he wanted. The cowman wanted. It was the cowman in charge. I was a cowboy, no lasso, and then we built this barbed wire fence around. He was very good. He hammered these posts in. I wasn't used to that kind of physical work at all. It was a good experience for me, that farm.
Were you the only refugee family working on in that area, to your knowledge? I
mean, absolutely. Absolutely.
How did would there be other farm workers, I suppose?
There were other farm workers, but I only knew the cowman. Mm-hmm. How my father got on with the others, I don't know. I know they called him Harry, which he said, call me Harry. That was one of the English ways of calling his name. Real name was Hermann. But a lot of people call him Harry. But how he got on with them, I don't know. I would think that in the country there wasn't much resentment. The war had started. There was a shortage of workers anyway. And I'm sure my father was as good a worker as anybody. He was 50.
Did you see anything of the war in those first few months?
No, nothing. It was a phony war, wasn't it? Mm. No, I saw nothing of the war. I knew there was a war. I gradually developed a dream. I got up at 4 in the morning, went to the bale. By the time when we'd built that fence, then we started calling, then the cows came in. They knew what it meant. It meant food. And there were 3 cows at a time into. Have you ever seen those milking bales? You have. We'll go in, and the machine milked them, and then before they were milked to the end, we had to hand milk the rest, and the milk was straight, went through a pipe straight into the milk churns. And there were 10-gallon milk churns. When the cows had been, he could be very nasty, that cowman, if one of the cows kicked, and they would if something hurt them or something, he twisted their tails until they cried. But on the other hand, he was an extremely skillful cowman. And I learned something I've never forgotten. I learned something then and there. I could speak French and German and English, and I could read and write, and I could do all kinds of things. I could write music, I could play the piano, and I could play the mandolin. But who was more important? He or I? He was. You can live without people speaking foreign languages. You can, people can exist without most of these skills, without doctors, even without scientists. They can't live without food. And that was my first lesson in having it was the first time I began to have some sort of consensus of value. That's not the right word. Some sort of what values are important? What is important?
Priorities.
What are priorities? That's the word. A priority of values. And I've never lost that. I've never lost that. It gets me into a lot of trouble with people in arguments, but I've never lost that. You know, people don't like it. They say, well, it's all right, you can do this, you do that, you earn very good money, but without the peasant who grows our food, without, we can't live. And really, they should be earning what you're earning. You're a bloody communist. I'm not. That's any communist didn't have those values anyway. Then I heard the next step, the next thing that happened in my life, that I learned that I could join the army. I was eager to join the army. I felt that was my, by now I had one clear-cut political view. Hitler was my enemy. I had been thrown out of Austria as far as I was concerned. My parents had been tired of it. My brother was in Palestine, my younger brother. I should have really gone with him. I had a bad conscience about that. Didn't want to go to Palestine. I don't think anyone expected me to. I wonder whether my mother wouldn't have been happier if I had gone with him. Oh, I didn't really want to. And it didn't occur to me at the time that I had any kind of responsibility. I mean, he was 15 or 16. He was no longer a little kid, but he was my younger brother. And the moment I could, I joined. I wrote to the army, and I was recruited in Reading. Oddly enough, I had been told beforehand that people like me, we had all come before a board to be assessed as to whether we were enemy aliens or friendly aliens, and I was classified as a friendly alien, free from being put into a prison of war camp and a refugee from Nazi oppression. I think that was the official term.
Very roughly, can you remember when that was?
Yes,
after the outbreak.
It was just after the outbreak, about October. What's more, I've got this amongst my memorabilia.
And the letter from Reading would have been a letter.
Yeah, I've got that. And I got two letters, and they wrote me twice and gave me two different dates, I noticed. I don't know which one I went to, but only within 2 days.
And this was early 1940.
This was 1940, February 1940. And so when I came to this recruiting office the first time was to fill in a form. Although I had been told beforehand by the Refugees Committee that we would only not be allowed into a combatant unit, the form offered me a choice. So I filled. I wanted to go to the Air Force. So I filled in Air Force, and the next thing I had was an invitation to go to Kitchener Camp and join the Pioneer Corps, which was a non-combatant corps. So I had kidded myself. I'd actually started saying I'm hoping to go into the Air Force. You know. This was part of my romantic and dreamer things, but I really would have liked to go. I tried again later on during the war. And it was the second company, I believe. The first one was number 87, ours was number 88. In due course, we were taken to France. Well, then came the Dunkirk evacuation. By that time, we were still in France, actually. We were still in France until the 17th of June.
Just to run back a bit, what sort of training had you received after turning up at
Pioneer Corps?
Yes.
At Kitchener Camp? Well, a certain amount of ordinary military training, but no guns, no rifles, no weapons, but marching by the left, quick march, right turn, left turn, right wing, left wing. We had even learned how to present arms with something that was a substitute for a rifle. I can't remember what it was, but that wasn't pursued a lot because they knew we were non-combatant.
So you weren't issued weapons there?
No.
Weapon training?
We were not given any weapon training, only drill. Only drill. And a band was formed, which I quickly joined. And
Kitchener Camp, where was that?
Kitchener Camp is near Deal.
Oh, in Kent.
Yes, in Kent. What's the town next to Deal?
Sandwich?
Huh?
Sandwich?
Sandwich. That's where it was. Sandwich, yes. Huge camp full of people.
So you can't have been there long before you moved to France?
No. No, I think about a month or so. Well, they had to clear the camp for the next lot, and for the next lot there was an awful lot of people joined. Yeah. I remember walking out, there were four of us in that company whose name was Schwartz. You know, that was my original name, right? I remember walking out of the gate in the evening next to one of them, an older man, probably in his 40s, and as we came out, there were women waiting outside for various people, and some of them were very much painted lips and so on, and I was very pure about these things. I didn't think it was right that women should use a lot of rouge and things and so on, and I made a very derogatory remark about one of the women standing there, and he said, "Yeah, that's my wife." And he was a good bloke. He didn't hold it against me.
So it must have been quite strange to suddenly find yourself surrounded by presumably other people similar to you.
Or people like me, yes. And I was one of the youngest.
And did you find out, did you talk about your backgrounds and share?
We did gradually over a period. We got to know each other. Some became good friends, some less good friends. I was very good at football, so I was reasonably well known in the company, whereas there are a lot of people in the company I never got to know myself. I also took part whilst we were in France in a boxing tournament. I won my fight, so I'm one of the few British boxers who never lost a fight.
What were your duties in France? Why were you moved?
Well, first we were moved to Le Havre, where we had to move supplies from either from train carriages, that is, train carriages, cattle, from trucks into a warehouse, or from the in the docks, or from the docks, from the warehouse to onto one of the trucks that was taking them somewhere. That was our first job. That was our main job there. In fact, that's why we were there. We were stationed outside Le Havre, and then one night the Germans had broken through Belgium and so on, were attacked. Le Havre was machine gun. I remember that night we were up on a hill outside Le Havre, so strictly speaking the machine gunning was down in the docks, I presume, but I was on guard. We had all the full kit that any soldier had,
no weapon.
But we had one weapon, a genuine broomstick without the broom at the end. Absolutely true. I stood there my 2 hours on guard with this broomstick in my hand and heard the cluttering of the machine gunning down in the harbour. I didn't know, I wondered what I would do. It's very odd. But I have to say, I was pleased. I was in a petticoat. Beginning in those days, and quite a while, I tended to do what I shouldn't have done, try to dodge work, you know, make things easy for me wherever I could. Later on, I developed a sense of enjoying physical work, enjoying seeing the result of what you've done. Yeah. So this was another good experience in my life for me, a very good experience. After the farm, this was a very good complimentary experience. Anyway, we were